Hi everyone, welcome again to Podchat Live with myself and Craig. This is episode 115, and we are recording this on the 27th of February, 2024. We are going to try and stick to time as we always do. I like to keep quite strict times on these. I'm very keen on them staying short, but we've actually got four papers we'd like to discuss. We've got a bit of a challenge of squeezing it all in, so. Without further ado, quick bit of housekeeping first. Ratings update. On Apple, we're now at 28 ratings. And we've also had a review, which I quickly want to read out because I enjoyed it. It was from Eat Cake and Run, which is a great username. I think we can all make our peace with eating cake and running. And their review says, honestly, the best podcast about feet keeps me up to date with the latest in the world of podiatry. Always interesting and informative, easy to listen to. Every time I listen, I learn something new. That's just lovely. There feels like there's about four different compliments in there, and they all make me feel fuzzy and warm. So thank you, Eat Cake and Run. And if anyone else wants their reviews shouted out on the podcast, please head over to Apple, leave us a rating, leave us a review. Last bit of housekeeping as well. We briefly mentioned last week that we were going to invite people to try and beat James's photo listening to the podcast in Costa Rica. I've had several people send me messages, even send me photos of really nice places where they are. Most of them are my friends in Australia who are obviously enjoying the summertime while it's all miserable and cold here. But it doesn't count if you don't show us the podcast on your phone screen. So you don't have to, doesn't have to be a selfie. Don't need to put your face in it. Just an outstretched arm holding a device with the Podchat Live sort of podcast visible, and then a beautiful backdrop. Please do keep, do start sending those in. Craig, before we kick in with the articles, we often do a shoe fact. Last week we did a shoe fact about Donald Trump releasing a shoe, and here we are 7 days later. We have an update.
He may be in a spot of bother.
Surely not.
It turns out Louis Vuitton has a patent or a trademark on the red sole that his shoes are coming out with. It actually turns out the shoes haven't been produced yet. They're all on pre-order, and they're already being resold on eBay for like quite a bit more than they originally paid. But no one's actually got their hands on a shoe. So Louis Vuitton have this the trademark on the iconic red sole that Trump has done. They have a track record of suing to protect that trademark of theirs. Certainly no indication that they're going to be suing Trump to try and stop his shoe. I'm assuming that the sole purpose of him releasing the sneaker range was to help raise money for his legal battles. If he gets sued for this, it'll end up costing him substantially more. But what's interesting is sort of the social media reaction to this. And there's some interesting speculation as to some people are pleading with Louis Vuitton, please, please, please sue Donald Trump. Others speculating that the risk to Louis Vuitton from the MAGA crowd may not be worth it. The commercial consequences to them may not be worth it. So, yeah, let's just watch the space to see what happens.
Marvelous. Anything that keeps giving us weekly podcast content can't be a
Oh,
terrible thing for us, can it?
never a dull moment in the Trump world.
No, I thought you were going to say in the shoe world then, but you're probably right in
Oh,
both facts.
and in the shoe world. Yeah, it's great when they both combine,
Absolutely. A completely unintentional segue, but our first article we want to talk about this week is actually about running shoes. It's in this month's edition of the Journal of Biomechanics. We were made aware of it over just the last week. And it's from a group of researchers from the University of Memphis, actually led by Max Paquette, who I consider a friend now after I met him and spent some time with him in Brisbane at the APOD-A conference last year. Super, super cool dude. And they collaborated with Izzy Moore, who's from Cardiff University, and she may well be known to listeners of Podchat Live because she was on episode 16 with us all the way back in March 2018, nearly 6 years ago now, I guess. They've published a paper which is called "Time to Stability of Treadmill Running Mechanics in Novel Footwear with Different Midsole Thickness." And ultimately, what they've done here is they've looked at what sort of time would be appropriate with respect to treadmill familiarization in different footwear. We already know that when we get people on treadmills, we should probably give them time to familiarize. I think most of the literature points to somewhere between 8 to 10 minutes if we want their kinematics on the treadmill to sort of as closely mimic overground movement as possible. But what this showed is that when they looked at kind of what they call novel footwear, so footwear that was different for the 15 participants in this study to the footwear they normally wore, and they did it in three different types: minimal, a good old Vibram Five Fingers, haven't heard of that for a while; the neutral shoe was the New Balance 1080, and then the maximal shoe, which they referred to, was the Hoka Bondi. And what they found is ultimately that 2 to 3 minutes is sufficient time for familiarization, or for essentially kinematics to stabilize. So I think the clinical take home here potentially is that when you get someone on a treadmill, you should give them at least 2 to 3 minutes of time in their shoes. And that can either be sort of overlapping with or additional to the 8 to 10 minutes that you probably need to give people on the treadmill. So if you're getting people on the treadmill in their shoes and videoing them before 2 to 3 minutes, you may well not be seeing a truly valid reflection of their movement patterns. Anything to add, Craig?
No, I think from a research perspective, the assumption, and that was, again, evidence-based, is that 10 minutes was the requirement. And I know in research we've done previously, we would allow 10 minutes acclimatization before we'd even think about collecting data. So they're getting stability in a lot of the parameters after a matter of minutes, which is can only assume to be a good thing.
Speed things up, right?
It does, yeah, it does throw up the usual debate about how valid is treadmill running versus overground running. We could devote several episodes to research on that.
Yes. I think we promised. We promised our friend Jorn from Belgium last week that we would do so at some point in the future, didn't we? So this is sort of along those lines.
Yeah, well, my standard answer to that question is it depends on the parameter you're trying to measure. You know, some are the same as overground, some are different. So, yes, it's...
Yeah. But a lovely sort of short commentary there, which obviously, as with all these papers, and as always, we will link to. Moving on, second paper. This was published 4 days ago, 23rd of February, and it was published by a group of Korean researchers in Diabetes Research and Clinical Practice. The paper is titled Association Between Antidepressants and the Risk of Diabetic Foot Ulcers and Amputation in Antidepressant Naive Type 2 Diabetes Mellitus Patients, a Nested Case Control Study. We'll come to whether you'd heard of the term antidepressant naive previously, Craig, because I know I certainly hadn't. But let's just quickly describe what they did. In total, and this was a nice large study. They took 791 patients who had diabetic foot ulcerations, and also 3,900 controls. So these were patients who had diabetes but did not have diabetic foot ulcerations, and they were matched for things like age and sex, and also the date of their type 2 diabetes diagnosis as well. They use the term everuse in the abstract, and I can't help but think that they might mean overuse. That might be a lost in translation thing. So when I say everuse, I'm reading this verbatim, but I think it should probably be overuse. But here's a few bullet points. Antidepressant everuse was associated with an increased incidence of diabetic foot ulcers compared with non-use. Bullet point two, an increase in diabetic foot ulceration risk was evident with increasing cumulative antidepressant dosage. And that was particularly among the tricyclic antidepressants and the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And finally, antidepressant ever users / overusers displayed a higher risk of diabetic foot ulcerations requiring amputation. So there's clearly some kind of correlation here. And I'm sure Craig will go in further into kind of what possible direction that correlation may be or could be, if not bidirectional. But their conclusion fascinated me because they stated that caution is advised when administering these types of antidepressants in diabetic patients to reduce diabetic foot ulcerations and the consequent amputation risk. Now, I don't know that we can glean kind of that kind of risk relationship from this, but what are your thoughts, Craig?
Well, just on that point, you should be using caution anyway in anyone with those drugs.
So, right. Well, yeah, good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, No, look, I think I had not heard of that term antidepressant naive, so I had to look it up. But it's just those who haven't been on antidepressants before. So it's
Right.
the first the
Is
first.
naive the best word there?
No, it's probably again, I yeah, well, no. I think
The
it's
new.
just it's like naive implies some sort of well, I'm thinking the right word, stupid,
Yeah,
like that,
or lack of understanding of them rather
lack of
than
understanding.
not having been on them. Yeah, absolutely.
So I think I think it includes that group of people. We don't know how they're going to respond when you give it to them. There are, behaviors, some of the side effects and behaviors can make things worse than those kinds of drugs. So, but I think the key take home for me from this study is that, we take our drug history in diabetes patients and then we file it away and move on. Well, no, you take that drug history for a damn good reason. And if they are on one of the antidepressants, that there are issues there related to their risk for diabetic foot ulcers.
Yeah. What are
Now
your thoughts? Sorry, go on.
we could speculate on the mechanism, and it may not be the actual drugs that are the risk factor. It could just be the behaviors, the lack of self-care in general from people who are depressed that may be the risk factor, but it's still a big red flag that their risk goes up.
Yeah, I agree. I think, again, nowhere near my area of expertise, but on the one hand, you could easily glance at this and think, is there some kind of biochemical reason why these drugs, contribute to foot ulcerations? Is it that people that are on these drugs are conducting their daily lives in a way that increases their risk of foot ulceration? Or is it that, because of this being ultimately a correlation study, is it that people that get ulcerations are more likely to then get depressed and be put on drugs? Does the drug cause the ulcer, or does the ulcer cause the drug prescription?
There's plenty of confounders or potential confounders, potential explanations there. That still doesn't detract from the value of the study in alerting
Agree.
us to this is a big issue.
No, totally agree. And we'd love people's thoughts on this if they have them. Please do message them in. Right, let's move on. Third paper. I think we're making good time. We might get all four here, Craig. This was from a group of Danish researchers, and as always with researchers from Denmark, and they're the best at this, in my opinion. We're talking big data here. They are really, really quite impressive at the way they do this. It's an open access journal in BMC Primary Care. It's one of the only papers that wasn't in the last week. It was actually published just before Christmas. We obviously missed it, but it was sent to us by one of our very good friends and colleagues from the Children's Podiatry Group, and it is entitled, "Does Children's Healthcare Seeking Change After Participation in a Musculoskeletal Study, a Register-Based Study?" So this is really lovely what they did here. In Denmark, back in 2008 to 2014, so that sort of 6-year period, there was something called the CHAMPS study, which was the Childhood Health Activity and Motor Performance School Study. And it essentially took many, many children between 5 and 17 years old. Ultimately, what they did, and this study kind of fed on from that, they grabbed as many of the participants of that study as they could 5 years later, and then compared them to two different control groups. And they looked at their health-seeking behaviors for physiotherapists, chiropractors, and GPs, both before the study and after the study, compared to the control group over like that really long period of time. So there was nearly 42,000 children data from children and parents in this study. And interestingly, the main finding was that there was a shift in preferences among the children who'd been in the CHAMP study compared to both the control groups. And these changes persisted for at least 5 years after the study had ended. Ultimately, their utilization of physiotherapy and chiropractic services increased, with a simultaneous decrease of their utilization of GP, general practitioner services. So they've sort of concluded that being in a research study, being involved in a systematic engagement of a research study, and these were participants that were kind of engaged with, had musculoskeletal complaints and were engaged with healthcare professionals. Being in such a study can influence your subsequent healthcare seeking behavior. So this for me is fascinating, not just from a principle that the way children's future, you know, the way someone behaves and seeks care as an adult is can be influenced by their childhood experiences. But actually, how many of us that do research really think, you know, we often, you know, we go through the motions, we get a consent form, we write our participant information leaflet, we tell people about what they're doing and why. How many of us really consider that we may be changing the way the participants in our study seek healthcare, you know, as many as 5 years later? Utterly fascinating, I think.
Oh yeah, definitely is. But just firstly, yes, they do these kinds of studies remarkably well in Denmark, but they have what is known as the Danish National Patient Registry, which is just an extraordinary database for epidemiological research that they sort of exist in some other countries, but not to the depth that they do. And they've pulled out so much data out of that over the years. I'm not sure of some of the privacy issues whether it would pass muster in other countries, but that's why they do it so well there. But I think the big take home to me from this study is participating in research can change health seeking behaviours. But the second big takeaway is they didn't really define whether that was a positive or a negative change. You know, were these subsequent health seeking behaviours inappropriate or overkill or the worried well? We don't know. I think the other comment I'd make is that it also could reflect the type of people that do choose to participate in research. You know, they're a cohort to those who choose not to. So they may be more susceptible to change in behaviours from participating in research. I don't know. But that still doesn't detract from the strength of the study that this certainly does happen, and we need to be conscious of it.
And really interesting how they seek more physiotherapy, chiropractic, but seek less GP. Ultimately, you know, it appears that if we engage people in too much care, they seek more care. And I think that's a really important message for many of us to kind of
Well, no,
consider.
but you could speculate that if a group of university-based podiatrists do a study, the participants may seek more podiatry care after the study. It's
Right, last one. And as always, Craig being you know, on the ball as he is and throwing me curveballs, we'd only planned to talk about those three. We often record these Tuesday night for me, as many of you know, Wednesday morning for Craig. And what my routine is, my wife comes home from work, I go out for a run, I come back, but just in time to put the kids into bed, grab a bite to eat. Then I open my laptop. It's about 8:30 p.m. right now. I open my laptop, jump online with Craig, and we record these things kind of, you know, without too much planning or prep, other than these are the three things we're going to talk about. And I went for a run, kind of thought about the three papers that we were going to talk about a little bit on the run. Came home, opened my laptop, and there's an email from Craig. He's found another paper to talk about. And here it is. So I've not read anything other than the abstract here. Craig, I've literally been aware of this paper for about 27 minutes. And it was published yesterday, classic Craig, February the 26th. It is open access. We will link to it. It is in the journal Perception. And it is called Running Together Influences Where You Look. This is from a group of researchers. Where are these researchers from? I'm not even too sure. The lead researcher is from the Netherlands, and it looks to me, based on the surnames, yeah, most of them are based in university in Amsterdam. And ultimately, they have looked at people running solo versus running with other people. And I'll just cut to the chase and read the abstract take home, like we tell our students never to do, but that's how unprepared I am for this. What they've shown is that you are likely to spend less time looking at the path in front of you when you're running alone, rather than when you're running with someone else. The thought process, I think, being that when you're alone, you kind of look up and around and you take in your surroundings. But when you're with someone else, the presence of another runner seemingly makes you believe that your foot placement is more critical. So you look down at the pavement more when you run with someone else than when you run alone. Craig, you may well have read it in a bit more depth than me, so please do add some colour to this.
No, that's exactly what they found. That when you're on your own, you're more likely to take in the scenery. When you're running in a group, you're less likely to look around. But I think for me, what sort of caught my eye was that I can recall quite a few studies on a similar topic about what running alone versus running in a group does. And obviously there are social reasons to run in a group. There are perhaps non-social reasons to run alone. I recall a study that looked at running cadence in a group versus running on their own. So there are differences in whether you run in a group in your biomechanics, as in the cadence. There are differences in your perception of the environment, and that's got to have an impact. I do run on my own. I do run with a group of other people. I mix it up. The problem is now I'm going to be so conscious of where I'm looking next time I run in a group that I'm probably going to influence my behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, we often say to runners that they need to run a large volume of their running at a bit lower intensity than they probably think or than they probably are. And we often refer to that as conversational pace. So another way to kind of maintain your pace is if you run in a group, and you're having conversations, you're probably less likely to run at an intensity that too intense too frequently, if that makes sense. So this group running versus solo running seems to be throwing up some really fascinating differences. And I agree. I enjoy both. I very much enjoy running alone. I do a lot, most of my running alone, just unfortunately because of logistics. But when I do get the chance to run with people at conferences or similar, I thoroughly enjoy it. But I'm like you, I'm going to be overthinking where I look now.
But did you remember a couple of weeks ago we talked about I can't remember what the research paper was, but I commented about when you go out for a run, when you're stepping over a curb, your mechanics changes. I'd hate to think how I every time I step over a curb now, I think of that episode we did,
Brilliant. Right. Four papers done and looking at my stopwatch. I have not violated my sort of time limits that are self-imposed upon myself. So let's wrap up by saying thanks again, everyone, for listening. Please do kind of rate us, review us, all that jazz. Follow us on social media, Podchat Live across all the usual channels. We publish the show notes on Twitter. You can email us questions, concerns, discussion points, papers you want us to talk about, or indeed photos of you enjoying the podcast anywhere. Email, as always, getinvolved@podchatlive.com. And we look forward to speaking to you again in another week. Thanks, Craig.
All right, thank you. We'll see you next week.